tweet at Today SOR.
And people have been tweeting and texting an email, todaysor@rte.ie, a lot about the school secretary. The secretary role covers so many areas. Paula hit the nail on the head. If 98% were male, there's no way they'd accept such a low salary. No pension, no sick or holiday pay. Women again being undervalued in the workplace. What year are we in? Asks Anne-Marie in Kildare. Another one, Sean. A few less printers bought and this whole situation could be paid for. On the topic of school secretaries, what about the other ancillary staff in our schools? The cleaning staff without whom the schools couldn't function. The cleaning staff in schools work under the same pay and conditions as school secretaries, but we are not acknowledged in any way, says Mary. Another Mary, Mary Feely, says, as a mum of three, I can assure you it is the school secretaries who run the schools. Another one, school secretaries are an integral part of the school. I worked with them as a teacher for 40 years in CBS in Nina. They look after students, teachers, visitors, parents, money, buildings, etc., says Marie or Mari. And then another one on this one, Sean, school secretaries are worth their weight in gold. They play an integral part in the life of the school. One of the many major changes in schools has been around transparency and accountability and incredible record keeping. Pay all secretaries what they are worth. That from a retired principal. These texts just keep on coming in. It's disgraceful how school secretaries are being treated. Seemingly 7 million per annum would sort this, around the same cost as the new carpets and paint job in Leinster House. 51551 for your texts. Now, our mental health services are failing the most vulnerable people in our society. That's according to my next guest, whose brother has been forced to use a prison sick ward for more than 3 years due to a lack of available beds elsewhere. Joseph Fay, who has a diagnosis of manic depression and schizophrenia. His sister Sandra Fay, who is a Solidarity People Before Profit counsellor for Talis South. Sandra is with me now in studio to tell me about Joseph and your family's struggle to get him the right kind of help. Thank you indeed for coming in. Tell me a bit about Joseph.
Well, Joseph would be my older brother, and I suppose growing up, he was extremely intelligent and he was extremely outgoing and extremely popular, and just a series of life traumas thrown his way, set him into a spin of mental health suffering, which I think can happen to anybody. I think we does this myth of normal and mentally ill. But there's like, it's like a spectrum.
Yeah.
And we're all just a tread away from it.
And there was a very difficult bereavement, I think, he had to deal with in his teens.
Yes. My brother had passed away and him and John were very close. And so that had a huge toll on him. But as well, I also think that we had a very stressful upbringing, because I've invested a lot of time in researching this. So I do feel that, like, understanding mental health and that the family stress, and particularly a parent's stress, has a huge effect mm-hmm. on children's mental health and then goes into their adulthood. And we were reared in a situation of poverty, and my mum was left to rear 5 children by herself, and she was also dealing with a huge amount of grief. But Joseph himself had personal trauma inflicted on him on top of that, so there was a lot for him to deal with. And I think we came from a culture when teenagers were acting out of saying, oh, sure, that's just teenagers and it's hormones. And I think we have to move away from that. And I'm a secondary school teacher, and when I see children acting out, I know it's not about me. I know it's not about the classroom. I know that there's suffering going on there, mm-hmm. that there is stress from their environment, from the home environment.
And when was it apparent that this was more than the normal teenage foibles, or if you like, just part of adjusting through adolescence, that actually there was an illness there that needed to be diagnosed?
After my brother's passing, I suppose you would have waited six, seven, 8 months. There was lots of signs in between there where he wanted to be called by my brother's name and stuff like that. But, you know, we were all dealing with grief, so we thought it was part of his way of dealing with grief. So we were unsure how to mm-hmm. separate the two. And then I suppose as it went on, it was within the year that you were saying, this is different. He'd withdrawn, he'd isolated, he became unwashed. He was, you know, symptoms that he doesn't do now, which is weird, that he would shake and rock himself for comfort. Mm. He would hear voices, the TV would talk to him, and he would display really stressful, manic behaviour. It was a year, year and a half.
And initially, I imagine you went to a GP and then you would have got maybe a psychiatrist assessment?
That's it. Well, you go... It doesn't really work that way when you're first being exposed. So you don't know where to go. You know, you're talking to your doctor. Yeah. Then the more research, I suppose, school guidance counselling, the IXS services to talk about what was happening in the family home. They said perhaps they think thought he had psychiatric, and then they sent us into family support services, and then they guided us in a direction. And then it was just an extreme event that forced us to get him involuntary admitted. It was like he tried to set the house on fire, you know, mm-hmm. but there was lots of similar incidents, but that was a big incident where we left the house in the middle of the night due to his psychosis, and we were out in the streets, and then we had to try and get him hospitalised and call the services out, and they...
And how did things progress from there? Because we're talking about something now. I mean, I think he's in his early to mid-40s at this stage, isn't that right?
Yeah, so he was 18, 19 at the time.
Yeah, so you're going... This is nearly 25 years of difficulty and trauma for him and for you and for your mum and for your other siblings. How did things progress? How did things unfold is probably a better way, because we're not talking about progress here, are we?
No, there's no progress at all. You don't know what to do. So you act, the services that existed at the time were St. Lobans and Lucan, and he was hospitalised there. But the method that we used then and we still use now, I don't want to harp back that was good, because it's never been good. We have the Mental Health Services of Ireland is the Cinderella of health services. I think prime time last night, people probably thought it can't be any worse. But when I describe the mental health services, it's, you know, 100 times worse when you think it can't be worse. And so basically it's an isolation model, it's a medical model, it was then, but you felt they were safe. You felt they were, because there's a vulnerability when someone's suffering with their mental health within the West. You think the Western world, where the medicine would be a safe place for people with mental health illness, but actually it's somewhere, it's villages in North Africa where they accept them, they embrace them, they belong to community. And we've had a history of isolating them when we know people need relationships to repair the damage to their illness.
But I mean, was there at any stage an opportunity for Joseph to be cared for in a community setting?
No. It was always isolated, it was always medication. Nobody ever wanted to get to the root of Joseph's trauma. And when we talked to the services and the model that they were using, even when you read the Mental Health Act, they talk about medication, electrolysis and lobotomy is, you know, the three big things they talk mm-hmm. about. But medication is the number one they use. And so they medicate him up. And when we talked and the model, we said, what about counselling? And we explained the huge amount of trauma that happened to him. And they said, no, it's like digging up a garden of weeds. You can't deal with a person with psychosis with counselling. And even now today, when I people in the that I'm aware of, and also Joseph, they cannot access counselling services. If you've psychosis, and even if your psychosis is under control, Peterhouse don't offer counselling services. There is no idea. Yeah. So you're always putting a stick and plaster on it. But now we can't even access the services to give them a safe space. It was never about curing them.
Yeah.
And it's never been that.
But Sandra, just explain to me, because I mentioned in the intro that your brother had been using a prison sick ward for more than 3 years. Now, how did that come about?
So the government shut down lots of the sick units, and they promised to use the funding to care for people suffering with their mental health within the community-based approach. And it was the Vision for Change in 2006. But that would require housing people, number one, which we know the government are not doing now. So that even when you talk to the psychiatrists and the services, the housing crisis is a root cause of them not being able to use their community services. They said that they would house them in the community and they would do a wraparound service within the community. But there is no housing. So people with mental health, like my brother, will not get independent living in the HAP. So they're forced to live like children in the family homes. And then the services are underfunded. Huge amount of cuts after austerity. Just in the recent budget, 16 million was given to Greyhounds, 6 million to mental health, even though we know it's on the rise, that it's the number one cause of illnesses in children and youth at the moment. And so there's no way that the facilities that are so short, that are having huge recruitment issues, can provide help and repair for Joseph.
No, is there any way, I mean, your mother must be getting on in years at this stage, it sounds from what you're saying that he's not in a position, or she's not in a position, to have him in the family home.
Well, what happened was, because the bed shortage became so extreme when we were using the Mental Health Act, and the guards would come out, only arrest Joseph if he presented extremely mentally ill, which he did, because that's the only time we would call them out. And we shouldn't be afraid of his illness, you know. But we call them out and they come and they take him and they call an independent GP, who then comes to the Garda station to assess Joseph to see is he mentally unwell. And what's happening and what the guards are reporting is the GPs are showing up who have no knowledge of Joseph, and they say, no, he's fine. But not just Joseph, this is happening. And it's leaving guards shocked at what they see. And they see that Joseph's definitely going to be in hospital tonight, and he's not. So they've advised us that the only way to keep Joseph safe and to keep my mom safe when he's suffering from his psychosis is to take out a barring order. But in order to take out a barring order, you're not allowed to have somebody live in your home. So she's been forced to make my brother homeless, and that's the only way we can secure his safety. It's not about getting him better. He's very vulnerable on the street. He's been attacked several times this year, really extreme attacks. His wrists have been slit, like really extreme. We're like, how do we get him safe? And so you're trying to think, well, the sick unit in Clover Hill has to be better than the vulnerability that he's having on the streets, while people who don't understand his illness are responding in a certain way. And so that's what my mother's been forced to do, use a barring order, which does get him into a sick mental health. And the only reason the doctor can be saying that Joseph is not as well is because he knows there's no bed. Because when he presented in front of a judge, the judge deemed him unfit to stand trial for over 4 months.
Sandra, it's as heartbreaking a story as I've listened to, you know, in over 6.5 years sitting in this chair. Pardon me, you're just wondering where are the signs of hope? And I find it difficult to see them, just listening to you, and like where are the ways out and through this. Is he in Clover Hill at the present time?
He's not in Clover Hill at the present time. He was released from the prison services when he was meant to be transferred to a hospital unit, and he was extremely ill, which is why the story became public, which led us to have to protest for a whole weekend in Tallaght Hospital to get him to access the mental health services, in which he got eventually. We were being sent home with a packet of pills because there was no bed. But eventually we refused to leave, and eventually we got access, and he got 8 weeks within the mental health services. And then he left. He left the hospital services without the advice of the doctors and ended up on the streets, being with the only services available to him was to access homelessness at 12 o'clock at night and leave at 7 in the morning. But thankfully, just before Christmas, we managed through huge struggle. And it's like winning a lottery for families. You have to put a huge amount of your daily resources into fighting for the bare minimum. And so now he has a room, and he doesn't have to check out in the mornings. He has a room for 6 months, but he doesn't have access to mental health services because the homeless mental health services are not able to take on more clients. And it's a recruitment crisis. There's only two in Dublin.
Is there anybody, he has a room close enough to the city centre from what you were telling me earlier. Is there anybody caring for him in that setting?
There's social workers. There's nobody there qualified to deal with his illness or his psychosis. But there's social workers who help, but nobody there to deal. And his medication has run out. So now we're back to the same situation we were originally. His medication, which is not the solution. Like, I don't believe in medicating people up. If we're sick, there's a root cause. And we now know there's enough there to be looking at it's the biopsychosocial model that we're affected by. Our environment and poverty and trauma.
Does he have a sense? I mean, does he have periods when he realises, you know, he has these illnesses, and that he's in a position to cooperate, or is it just you're trying to manage it with medication?
So he does not think he's ill, but he will say his mind is scrambled, and he will say his mind won't stop raising, but he doesn't see it as him being schizophrenic. He thinks he has telepathic abilities. And for whatever escapism that he needs for his trauma from his life.
With the right supports, if he got therapy and counselling and psychiatric support, what kind of a future or what kind of a life do you think he could have?
Oh, I think if this government committed, because we have to talk about Joseph, but we also have to talk about the fact that we know that parent stress is the number one indicator of mental health illness mm-hmm. in adults. And if we look now at the homeless crisis and the de-stress living that people and children are living in this moment. So we're creating the next generation of Josephs. All right. And we did through the Magdalen Laundries, we did through the industrial schools. And when are we going to stop that cycle? We have to build back our communities. We have to build back stable, non-precarity living. Like my brother now is not going to be accepted into employment. He's discriminated against. He won't be accepted into private rental. So he needs a magnitude of us going back and building into our communities. But right now we know that we could invest into the mental health services, into therapeutic and into looking at people's environment, changing people's lifestyle, changing the precarious living that's being created again and again.
Yeah. How much are you, I would surmise, Sandra, that you and others have put a huge amount of time and a lot of hours into try to help your brother and to sort this.
Oh, my mother, like there's no words for the amount of hours and work her daily, from the moment she wakes till the moment she sleeps. And it would, like, she's reared her children, her grandchildren, but Joseph has always come first. And the stress and the toll and the effort of every day. And like the first thing this morning, we need to get a hold, we need to get Mae's medication, we need to make sure. And that was the first thing this morning. But like you said, like the toll it takes, like last year, the reason that we end up saying, no, we have to do this, we have to, ma'am, put him out, because she collapsed in front of her neighbour and lost her whole bodily functions. And that was stress. And that was just no help, no support. And her needing that. And it's constantly being pushed back onto families. So when they came with the vision of change and said they put it back into communities, they haven't. They haven't built the homes. They haven't built the services. So they've said the families have to take on this double burden.
Sandra, thank you so much indeed for coming in. That's Sandra Fay there, a Solidarity People Before Profit Councillor for Talis South. Some text on this, we'll come to them later. It's just after 11. We go to the newsroom again and to Carla O'Brien.